Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I am your host, Shane Bacon, and this week we have a Hall of Famer, Julie Inkster, one of my favorite people in all of golf. Talk some Solheim Cup a couple of months after, talk about her golf game, and just dove into some issues. It was a lot of fun, and I asked her at the end, have you figured out golf? Do you know the secret? And you'll have to listen and hear the answer. Does she have the secret to the game, or is she still searching for that secret? This week's Clubhouse podcast, as all of the Clubhouse podcasts, are brought to you by my good friends at Titleist. And this week, I'm going to talk to you about the Pro V1. The Pro V1 and the Pro V1X have been redesigned for more speed, which is awesome, more precision, very helpful, and more consistency than ever before. And if you're going to compare the two, the Pro V1 has a softer feel and a lower flight than the Pro V1X. The Pro V1X has a higher flight with more spin and a firmer feel. That's the golf ball that I play. Both models continue to provide proven drop and stop greenside control, lasting durability, and unsurpassed quality. And both, and this is what I love, both now available in yellow. I've been playing the yellow Pro V1X for months. I just got back from Bandon Dunes. I had my entire bag stocked of the yellow Pro V1X. Nobody else in my group, none of my buddies brought a yellow golf ball. Always knew which one was mine. Always. If it was in a fairway, a bunker, green, wherever, you know which golf ball is yours. I love the yellow golf ball. I am not switching back anytime soon. And the good people at Titleist, they printed bacon on the side of my yellow Titleist 2s. And I'm a fan of them. I don't even have to put a Sharpie marker on them. That's how awesome the yellow Pro V1X is. A 17% thinner cover and a larger casing layer create the fastest Pro V1 and Pro V1X yet. Check those out. Give the yellow a try. Do it for me. I mentioned coming back from Bandon Dunes, got a chance to play the Sheep Ranch, 9 holes on that golf course that's opening next year. It's going to be awesome. It's already awesome, mind you. It is going to be, in my opinion, a top-ranked golf course at Bandon Dunes. I think anybody that's going to get a chance to play it or see it in pictures is going to agree with me. I mean, it's just the piece of property it's on, the ocean views, how many greens are on the ocean. The place is mint. We had an unbelievable time, as we always do at Bandon Dunes. Got a chance to do an NFL game last weekend. Did Bucks at Titans on the sideline. Definitely a different speed than doing golf tournaments. A lot of fun anytime I get a chance to do another sport. But yeah, we're in that time of year in golf where there's certain golf events on TV, but it doesn't consume your day. And then we'll obviously roll into the President's Cup. This weekend at my country club, Phoenix Country Club, is the end of the Champions Tour, the Charles Schwab finale. I'm going to go out there a couple of days and get a chance to check it out. The golf course is in great shape. The greens are ridiculous. We played it in an event the club had on Friday where we all got to go out there and smack it around. And I'm telling you, I'm not sure I've ever seen greens as smooth as the Phoenix Country Club greens are right now. So check that out. I know it's on TV this weekend. And that's enough for me. Let's get to Julie Inkster. And we welcome back into the clubhouse. It's been a while, Julie Inkster, the Hall of Famer, of course. A busy year. I was thinking you are part of the announcing team with us at Fox. You still play in half a dozen of events. You had a Solheim Cup captaincy this season. Are you finally getting to kind of relax and chill?
Yeah, it's been very nice. I'm not playing much right now, and with the Solheim done and Fox, I'm actually trying to find things to do during the day.
when you're you were a captain for the Solheim Cup 3 times, and I was around you early in the summer, midsummer, and then as you got closer and closer to having to make picks, how much time a week when it's a Solheim Cup year are you spending just doing stuff, researching, looking at how, you know, people are playing, having to do interviews and conference calls? How busy are you?
Well, the year after the Solheim, you're not too busy. You do uniforms and stuff like that, but leading up to the Solheim, every day you're kind of checking in with I have a main guy named Dennis Beggett, who works for the LPGA, and he runs the Solheim. So he and I are constantly talking each day, you know, whether it's, lunch menus, dinner menus, what time do you guys want to have lunch, practice schedule, do you guys want to go first, do you want to go second, off the front, off the back, just constant stuff that behind the scenes that no one really looks at. And we go over a year before and do like a site check. You check out the golf course, you check out the locker rooms. Are we staying on campus or are we staying offsite? So stuff like that, logistics, buses, cars, so stuff like that. But it's all fun. I mean, it's really like, I call it like planning a wedding. Like 6 months out, you have to do this. 5 months out, you have to do that. So, and being my third time, I kind of knew what to expect.
Well, we're a couple of months removed from it. I mean, obviously, I know you would have liked the finale to finish a little bit differently, but when you look back at it as a golfer, as a golf fan, as a fan of women's golf, as someone that has competed and obviously captained in Solheim Cups in the past, it has to be one of the most exciting finishes, not just in Solheim Cup history, but in golf history. I mean, to have a putt, I think the putt that Suzanne made, I feel like people don't totally understand that it was a make and you win, miss and you lose putt. I mean, there wasn't any in-between ground. And for that to kind of conclude the Solheim Cup, I mean, again, I know you wanted the USA to walk away with a trophy, but it was an unbelievable event, especially late in that Sunday.
Yeah, I have no regrets. I mean, my team played their heart out. And for Suzanne, it was, she makes, they win. She misses, they lose. And that's the thing with the Ryder Cup or the Solheim Cup. It's not about the money. I mean, okay, you win the tournament, and she celebrates. I mean, you saw when she made that putt, how everybody celebrated, and it's a team event, and that's what's so special about the Solheim Cup and the Ryder Cup is, you're not playing for yourself, you're playing for the person next to you. And yes, I mean, I would have loved to win, but I have no regrets. My team played their heart out. I mean, we had six rookies and three first-time players that were playing overseas for the first time in a Solheim Cup. I thought they played great, and it was great for women's golf.
Yeah, it was so exciting. And you obviously are so focused on certain matches. You're driving around, you're bouncing between certain people, you're talking, you're motivating certain players that need it. Maybe you're just kind of talking to other players that might need it during the matches. As someone that was watching, simply on my couch, there was a moment that just kind of flipped, and it was really, really late where I was thinking, USA's got this, USA's got this, USA's got this. And there was just this quick moment where I went, wait a minute, Europe might actually win this. Did you have something similar out on the golf course? Was there a feel that the momentum was kind of changing, or was it just a couple of matches late flipped?
Yeah, a couple of Latin matches late. I think it was close pretty much all day. There was a couple of matches that were going to go USA way, no doubt. And there's a couple of matches that were going to go Europe's way, no doubt. So it was those in-between matches that were just close all the time. And it was kind of Bronte Law and Allie McDonald's match that really flipped. I think on the 15th hole, she left it in the bunker. Bronte Law left it in the bunker and then ended up getting it up and down, making like a 10-footer for bogey to tie Allie. And then she birdied 16, and that kind of flipped there. The Suzanne Pedersen match was always close, back and forth, back and forth. So, and the thing is, I don't think anybody knows this, as a captain, I'm the only one that can give advice. So, someone can call in and say, hey, can you come out and talk to Angel Yin? Or, hey, and I could be, this golf course was so spread out. I could be on the front side and it'd take me 15 minutes to get over on the other side. So, there was a lot of logistics problems, but, yeah, it flipped quick, but in match play, as you know, it can flip.
Yeah, I mean we get a chance to cover, these amateur events together throughout the summer, and I mean that happens all the time. I mean we see it from the broadcast booth. You obviously, as you're saying, see it as a captain. You're one of the more competitive people I've ever met. I think that's fair to say. When you're in the golf cart and you're watching these things, I mean I can only imagine you're itching to be out there playing or wanting to hit a putt. I mean, how hard is that 3 years into being a captain, three captaincies in? When you're in this position, how hard is it to kind of keep your emotions in check, considering, again, how fiery you've always been out on the golf course?
It's hard. I mean, it's hard. As you know, golf is a really tough game.
Right.
And you put the pressure of being on the Solheim or the Ryder Cup or whatever it is, and it's intensified. And I've been there, and I know how tough it is. Watching players, whether it be the European team or the American team, the pin's on the right, and there's no way you can miss it right. It's short side yourself, and they miss it right, and you're like, oh, my gosh. You just hit the middle of the green, so stuff like that, But I know how tough it is. And so I would never, ever, get down on anybody, whether, they had a good day or a bad day. I'm just there trying to moral support. And really my job is to make it a fun week.
Right.
And I think, we had probably the best loser party ever that we've had. It was epic. And, having six rookies on the team, they go, God, I can't even imagine if we won what it was like. So they have good memories, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, you and I talked a lot about just the youth of this American team. And as you were going into it, you were kind of eyeballing some of the veterans that were having good weeks or maybe were trending possibly in the direction of making the Solheim Cup team. When you have all these young players, I mean, are you talking to other people in other sports that have dealt with, youthful programs before, youthful organizations, or you're talking to other captains that have worked in the similar positions before, trying to find ways to make these people as comfortable as possible? Because, you're out there on the first tee. I mean, Brad Faxon tells a great story at the Walker Cup where his partner couldn't even pull the trigger on the first tee in his first ever Walker Cup team, and Brad had to hit the tee shot. I mean, it is a different type of pressure, way different than a major championship or trying to win an event for yourself.
Well, and Shane, everybody handles it different. Some people say, like a Daniel King, I mean, they relish it. I mean,
right.
They want to be on the first tee. They want to be hitting the shot. Everybody's personality is different. Everybody handles it different, but I can kind of see what's in their eyes. If they need a little pep talk, and really, I mean, you can tell them what is going to happen, but until they experience it, until they go through it, you don't really know what to expect. I mean, I had a really good conversation with Marina Alex, who I thought played great all week. She was kind of just under the radar, but very consistent. I played her with Morgan Pressel for a couple alternate shots. And we were having breakfast, and she goes, this golf is so much harder than individual golf. And I said, it is. I said, but you realize how much more you have in yourself when you play in something like this and how you can go to the next level. And she goes, you're right. She goes, I never knew that I could play like this under this much pressure. And you do, you learn a ton about yourself, whether it's, good or bad. And that's what the Solheim Cup brings out in players.
Yeah, and every time the Solheim Cup happens, I feel like the LPGA and women's golf gets a big boost. And it's exciting. It's a must-watch. If you like any sort of sport, competitiveness in any regard, you've got to watch it. What could the LPGA do? What could women's golf do to kind of piggyback off a Solheim Cup so that they kind of ride that momentum wave for a couple of months for, basically into the next season? Or is there something they could do to kind of attach themselves to the Solheim Cup and how many eyeballs are on it to help push the tour a little bit more?
Well, the problem is, it's like, we have the Solheim Cup, and then I think they had a couple domestic, and now they're over in Asia for 4 weeks. So they kind of lose a little momentum on that, especially being at the end of the year. But I really don't know. I think we're a global tour, and over in Malaysia and Korea and Taiwan and Japan, women's golf is huge. I mean, the crowds they draw over there is unbelievable. And you know, over here, I hate to say it, but you know, women's sports is not valued like it is over in other countries. And you know, it's not only just golf; it's, you know, basketball, it's hockey, it's, you know, other sports that women play, college sports all the way up, and then they get done and they got nowhere to go. So it's a slow process, Shane, but I think it's getting better, especially with the women's initiatives that are coming out right now.
Well, I wanted to ask you for your memory. I know you've got a lot of them, but you've captained three teams. And you also said you're done, which you said after Iowa, by the way. But I actually believe you this time and say you're not doing this again. But is there a memory that sticks out? I mean, you played in so many Solheim Cups, and I always know how important that part of the competition was for you. You're a captain three times. You win twice. You lose in this epic, epic finale across the pond. Is there a memory that sticks out to you that you'll always carry with you as a captain of Team USA that you'll never forget?
Well, I think the dinners at night are the things that I will treasure. You know, a player standing up and talking. I think probably one of the best times is my first one over in Germany with Angela Stanford and Christy Kerr. They weren't best of friends. Two completely different personalities, but they really kind of bonded that week and really kind of sorted out why they've never really got along, and they finally understood that they're just different personalities, handle things different ways. And Christy Kerr, every day on the bus, would get up and read a quote from somebody, and Angela would then interpret the quote. And it was pretty cool to see two gals that really never got along, really learn to respect each other and respect how they go about different things. And that's something I'll never forget.
Yeah, it's I can only imagine 2 months after this Solheim Cup wrapping up that you've probably had time to kind of look into yourself at this point in your career, because I mean, as I said, you were an unbelievable Solheim Cup player. What was your record as an individual? Were you 12-1?
I don't know.
It was good.
Yeah. I only lost once. I know that, but I don't know how. I think I was 8-1.
8-1. I mean,
no,
that's polished.
No, I was 7-1-1. I tied Laura Davies 7-1-1.
So, you know, you play in so many, you're a captain three times. You kind of got a chance to see it all. Is this going to be something that 4 or 5 years from now that you're really, really going to miss? Or is this something you think you'll always be, you know, I mean, you know, if captains call you or they need advice or they want help, you'll always kind of be there to help out?
No, it's something I'm going to miss, definitely. You know, I would definitely do it. I'd do it for the next, you know, whatever Solheims. But it's such a great experience that other people should be able to experience it. And, you know, I've done it, and I think the Solheim's at a great place right now. And, you know, there are the Christy, you know, the Pat Hurst, the Christy Kerrs, the Angela Stanfords, Paula and Morgan that are really in line now, you know, maybe Michelle Wee that are in line to kind of do this now. And there was kind of a gap where, you know, Christy and Angela were playing, and there wasn't really anybody that was next in line. And I think that's why they gave me the opportunity to do it. So I am going to miss it, but I am also always going to be a big part of Solheim. I mean, I won't miss one. I'll be over there, you know, hopefully they'll let me be a helper and I can walk in the ropes and watch a match or two. But it's a big part of my life, and it's something I'm proud of. I've always been a team kind of player. I grew up playing team sports, and it's kind of funny I play in individual sports because I love team sports so much. But it'll definitely always be a big part of my life.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I always say there's two types of pros, you know, people that have played professional golf for decades. You know, there's the player that had it. It was their job. It was what they did. And once they're kind of done with it, they don't part ways, but they're not passionate about playing still. And then there's the people like you who still play and still grind and still look for the answer and the secret to golf. And when I'm with you throughout the summer, I mean, you're out there before the broadcast with Brad Faxon on the putting green going over stuff. You're always hitting range balls. I would say you kind of define what a golfer is because you obviously got the pedigree and the resume to back it up, but you're always searching still at this point in your career to perfect your craft and your game, and you're still competing. You're still playing a lot of events. It's still something that you do day to day.
I am so weird in that I love the game of golf, and it's weird. I mean, a lot of people, like you said, once they get done, they're done. They've hit their last ball. They don't want to play. They don't want to compete. I love playing. I just, it's weird, but I'll play with anybody as long as they're fun. They have to be fun, and they have to be able to banter. But you're right. I like tinkering. I like, I think the solidarity of just being on a range by yourself, listening to some music. I mean, really, I mean, that's a pretty cool office. And I look forward to getting up and going out and hitting balls.
Yeah, it's fun. I brag about our Fox golf team a lot because we have a group that really does enjoy each other, and we enjoy not just on air and working and preparing and getting set for the week, but, you know, we have a lot of fun off air. I mean, we go play golf a lot together. And, you know, one of the things that I've always observed is that everybody that we work with is in the second category. I mean, Brett Quigley and Brad Faxon and yourself and our boss. I mean, there's so many people that we work with that they are a part of golf because it's a part of their job, but they absolutely will go play any golf course anywhere with anybody, and they don't, and it doesn't matter. I mean, if there's daylight to be had, we're going to go out and find nine holes to play. And you and I had a great experience this summer. We played Sand Valley up in Wisconsin after a broadcast one day of the U.S. girls, and we carried our own bags and we kind of played like makeshift nine holes, and we got done and had dinner, and we were all saying, you know, this is what golf is. I mean, it's wonderful to be playing between ropes and playing for cash, but it felt a little bit like golf when we were kids.
It did. Of course, I think Brett Quigley and I bought dinner that night. But, I think we were a bit of the losers. But it is, and you know, you look at our crew, we all like to banter. And, you know, we banter, you know, when we're off air, and we banter when we're on air, too. But and that's what makes it fun. And we all love the game, and I think we're all very happy and fortunate that this game is in our lives, because I can see the passion that we all have for it. You know, and as Brett Quigley, you know, he just turned 50, and you know, I know we're all wishing him luck so he gets back out on that senior tour, because he's got a lot of game left, and I'd love to see him compete out there.
Yeah, I had dinner last night with Steve Flesh and his wife, and you know, Steve works with us a little bit. Obviously, he's playing a lot on the Champions Tour. And I said, you know, did you have a fun year? Have you enjoyed the season? He was kind of battling an injury last year. And he's like, I absolutely love playing. And he said, I go home for 2 weeks and I get stir crazy and I get antsy and I want to be out there and I want to go out and compete again. And it's to this whole passion of the game and love of playing. And it's fun that it's still great for people like you and Steve Flesh, that you still are excited about it and you want to get out there and play, because, you know, you've been doing it for, you know, 20, 30 years, and you're going to keep doing it. I mean, you've got tournaments next year you're going to play in.
Well, I think also, you know, it's like a Steve Flesh or Brett Quigley. I know Brett was hurt a lot, but you get to a point where really you can't compete with the younger players, and you're burned out, and you've been playing golf since college and, you know, full time, da da da, and you get to a point where I'm over it. And then, you know, you wait a couple years, and then I think when you get to be 50 or 49, 50, 51, you really appreciate what you had and being able to play on a professional level and then giving an opportunity to compete again with your peers that you played in college golf with and that you played on the tour. And I think you get to a point where you appreciate what you have instead of, boy, I have to go out and play again, or I have to travel here and I want to be home with the kids and da da da. Now your kids are grown and, you know, maybe they're off of college and then you have this second life and the second win where you appreciate what you have and being able to compete and play.
Yeah, I mean, on the flip side of that is these young players that are basically deciding on when they're going to turn professional. I mean, we follow a lot of the young amateur players. Lucy Lee announcing this week she's going to turn professional. That's somebody we have watched a lot. I mean, it feels like she's 40 years old and she's a teenager still. But there's a lot of pressure, Julie, on these young players. I mean, there's so much pressure to turn professional. I mean, Michelle Wee, you know, turns pro really, really young, and we've seen players kind of follow in her footsteps. How much pressure on some of these young players that have early success in the amateur, basically in the amateur world, and they play well maybe in a U.S. Women's Open or they have some success in some LPGA events? How much pressure's on them to turn professional quickly and get out there and start competing?
Well, I don't think it's pressure. I think it's the opportunities there. You know, I know Lucy's been, as you said, competing. You know, we saw her at 12 at the U.S. Open at Pinehurst. I think a lot of it is expectations on these kids. The LPGA right now is stacked with great young players that are really good. I mean, there is a huge difference to be playing college golf and playing professional golf. You know, you can be a great collegiate golfer, but the next level up is completely different. They're good. They're very long and athletic. You know, you look at someone like a Nelly Korda, who's 20, and she's the highest ranked American right now. But she's got pedigree, and she's tall and long and lengthy. And as you know, in the men's game, it's gotten to be a bomber's game. I mean, you just look at the money list and who's on top. I mean, you don't see anybody that is average off the tee. They're all bombers. And it's the same way on our tour. And that's where I think a lot of these players coming out is they're just not physically developed yet. And I think the problem is if they do start out and struggle a little bit, how they handle that.
Take a quick break in our conversation with Julie Inkster to just remind you that the Pro V1 and the Pro V1X have been redesigned for more speed, more precision, and more consistency than ever before. And if you're going to compare the two Titleist golf balls, the Pro V1 has a softer feel, lower flight than the Pro V1X. The Pro V1X, the golf ball that I love to play, has a higher flight with more spin and a firmer feel. Both models continue to provide proven drop and stop, greenside control, lasting durability, and unsurpassed quality, and both are available in yellow. I'm not going to go into how much I love the yellow golf ball again, but you know how much I love it. I love the yellow Pro V1X. Prove how good you can be. Tee up the Pro V1 or Pro V1X on your next round. Back to Julie. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to play for a year and, you know, not have a top 10 or not have a top 20 and think to yourself, am I good enough to do this? And I mean, I can only imagine that when you're bouncing between Symetra and the LPGA Tour back and forth and back and forth, and you're seeing the successes of somebody, as you mentioned, that's 20 years of age, that's one of the best players in the world. I mean, it can be discouraging. I mean, that's the scary part for me as a fan of some of these people is, you know, when you turn pro, there's no real turning back. I mean, you're not going to flip back and be an amateur and go, you know, actually, I am going to go to college for 2 or 3 years. You know, when you turn pro like Akshay or Lucy Lee, you're now doing this for a living. And there are times where it is a grind and it is grueling and you're on the road and your game's not there. And I mean, it can feel overwhelming. And to your point, the LPGA Tour has gotten, you know, so polished that if you're not absolutely on the top of your game, I mean, you're not even going to sniff week to week.
Yeah, I mean that's where you're out there by yourself. The thing with college, I mean, not everybody is wired to go to school and get a degree. I mean, I get that. But what's wrong with going to a year to college just to really learn how to be by yourself? Because a lot of these kids are going to be traveling with their parents, and as a mom, and as you as a father, there's no way you're going to let your 17-year-old kid or daughter, boy or daughter, go out and play on the tour by themselves.
Right.
So you're going to be with them. So the whole social part of it is it's now a full-time job at 17. You work out, you play, you practice, you go to bed, you work out. I mean, it's day after day after day. One, are their bodies going to hold up? And two, mentally, are they strong enough to go through the ups and downs of being a professional golfer? And that's kind of where I worry about is, how are they going to right the ship when a lot of these kids have never really not had success? Now, they've always been, the top amateur, or they've always played well in amateur events, match play, the junior, the trans, the Western, all of these things. But match play, as and medal play are two different components. And are they going to be strong enough mentally to play day in and day out and handle the successes and the failures the right way?
Yeah, I mean, you think of two young players over the last few years on the men's and women's side of golf, and you've got, Lydia Ko on the women's side and Jordan Spieth on the men's side, and they burst on the scene. I mean, they were unbelievable. I mean, Lydia was much younger than Jordan Spieth, but I mean, Spieth wins on the PGA Tour as a teenager. Lydia's kind of winning everything. And now they're going through this lull in their careers where they don't have the same game and they're not dominant and they're not the talk of the town week to week to week. And to your point, that's still your job. I mean, it's still what you've got to go do. I mean, I'm sure players come to you at times for advice when they're struggling. And what do you tell someone that's 2, 3, 4 years into their professional career, and it's not exactly where they hoped it would be?
Well, I mean, I say, everything comes in cycles and stuff. It's really, when you're playing well, it's easy. It's weird. I mean, it's like, you hit it in the trees and it bounces out in the fairway. And when you're not playing well, when you hit it in the trees, it's right behind a root. Or it is incredible how, when things are going bad, how things go bad. And what I say is, you can't get it all back in once. I mean, it's all about confidence. It's getting your confidence back. And believe me, for someone that's gone through a ton of cycles with my game, because, I kind of had a start before kids, and then I struggled, and then I had it after kids, and then I struggled. And so, to me, it was all about not the end results. It was more the results of how I'm playing hole to hole. I mean, I just really tried when I was in not playing well. It's okay. Today, I just want to shoot under par. I don't care if it's one under or five under. I'm just going to shoot. It was all about baby steps, is building that ladder again of confidence and competitiveness and learning how to get back in the saddle again. Because when you're not playing well, you can get woe is me. And that's the worst thing you can do. You always got, I always told my Solheim Cup players, I don't care if you're five down or five up, you keep your head up and you keep marching, because golf is really what you do. It's not who you are. It's not the person you are. And sometimes your golf can affect who you are. And that's when things go south.
Yeah, I was talking to James Hahn a couple of years ago. We were playing in some, media event, and he had that long, missed cut streak, and then he wins the Wells Fargo out of nowhere. And he said that when he was in that streak of missing cut after cut after cut, he would hit it in a divot, hit the fairway on the fourth hole on Thursday, and it would be in a divot, and he would get so frustrated. He would look at his caddy, he would say, "This is why I'm going to miss the cut by one," or, who gets these kind of breaks? And it was basically a mentality change of it's okay, you know, go out there and, you know, as Paul Ezinger always says, if you hit it in a bad spot, show off. You know, you want to go show off to everybody, I can still hit this shot. And he said he had to kind of flip that thought because, it, to your point, the woe is me was following him around, even if he was hitting good shots and getting the bad breaks.
And that's where, you know, James, he's kind of figured it out at a certain age. And, you know, that's what I worry about these younger players is not being able to figure that out. And then all of a sudden they just disappear. You don't see them again. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to follow, Lucy Lee and see how she does. You have Albon Valenzuela and Andrea Lee who just got their card. But they still have, another semester at Stanford. So it'll be interesting what they do, what they decide to do. Are they going to be, Fozzie or
Kepcho.
Yeah. Is she going to go back and defer and come out? So you got all these things, happening on the tour, which I think is good because people start talking about it.
Who is the most, I'm not saying the best, but who over the last year, year and a half, 2 years, who has impressed you the most with their games on the LPGA tour?
Well, that's a good question. There's so many good. I think Minji Lee could be the number one player in the world. She's got such credibility. But after playing with the Solheim and watching these two Korda sisters, it's impressive. It's impressive how good they are and how good that family is. The athletic ability is off the charts, but watch out for Nelly Korda. Nelly Korda has the inside part that wants to be number one. Jessica is a hell of a player and loves to compete, but she also really likes to have fun and enjoy her time, which is fine.
Right.
But I think those two are going to be fun to watch. Aria Buchanagarn is, she's got so much potential and she's still so young. But is she going to get better or is she going to burn out? I mean, that's kind of where she's at right now, I think.
Well, last question, and I was going to save it for the last one because I would say it's, I don't know if it's complicated, but it was a strange thing this week, this whole Christina Kim rules deal. And I don't know how much you read up on it or looked at it, but a couple players in Q school were signaling clubs and Christina waited till after and told the rules official and the players got two-stroke penalties. It's a rule that I feel like is one of the simpler rules in golf. You can't give advice to a player or a caddy. You can look over at a bag and see what club they hit. I mean, there's a lot of little workarounds that golfers do throughout rounds and throughout tournaments. But I feel like Christina Kim gets kind of, for whatever reason, was villainized for this, and she did nothing wrong, especially in a Q school situation where you're literally playing for a job.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's a basic rule that everybody knows, but it's also kind of a basic rule that everybody, there's a huge gray area there because, as people that work for Fox and for the people that are on the ground, TV commentators, you need those caddies to flash those fingers so you know what they're hitting. So I'm on the right side of the fairway and Kay Cockrell's out there commentating and my caddy flashes, three for an 8-iron. Well, the person next to me sees that, so they know I'm hitting an 8-iron. I have to say I've never seen a player put up three fingers or four fingers, but I see the caddies do it all the time. And I mean, you still got to hit the shot.
Right.
They didn't even hit the club that they said they hit.
Right.
One hits a 9 and one hits a 7-iron. But to Christina's, it is a rule and it was broken. And I think they both owned it. you know, the problem, that the thing that I have a problem with is the caddy for the other player. The player didn't even know this was going on.
Right.
And she's hitting the shot. She doesn't even realize this is going on. And it is a player and a caddy. They're a team. There. So if your caddy messes up, you take the brunt of it. So there is a huge gray area. And so is the USGA going to do something about it? Now, I mean, I think now everybody's kind of on standby right now that, all right, you know, I know Bubba Watson's a huge opponent of never giving,
right,
even to anybody, even to the TV commentators, to the player, to a player next to him. But he, I mean, really is the only one I've ever known not to, you know, flash a caddy fingers or whatever. So, you know, was Christina in the wrong? No, she was totally in the right. With the other girls, I mean, you have to know that rule. That's a basic rule. Does it happen all the time? It happens a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was kind of what the takeaway was, is that you get this a lot because it happens consistently. But to your point, rarely is a player doing it. It's mostly a caddy that's doing it to a spotter for TV or to anyone. What I was going to ask you, Julie Inkster, what's the worst ruling you've ever received, and maybe the maddest you've been about a ruling in your career? Like you yourself, like you were like, I need a drop here, or I did this, or somebody called you out on something. Do you ever have a moment that stands out?
Oh yeah, well I got two of them, but I'll just, well, the one that was called on me, I was in Portland, I want to say probably 10 years ago, 8 years ago. I was in probably the last group, maybe the second to the last group, and we had like a half hour wait on number 10. And for some stupid reason, I get out my little donut and put it on my club on the 10th tee, and I start swinging to kind of loosen up again. Well, you can't do that. I mean, so someone saw it on TV. They called it in. I finished the nine holes. I didn't really, you know, didn't realize I had a violation. I was in third place going in the last round. They hit me on the, in the tent, rules violation. And I didn't even get two shots. I just got DQ'd.
Oh no.
Which is a little drastic, I thought. But, and then, as you know, my other one was, a drop at the open, in the U.S. Open at Oakmont in 92. Patty Sheehan hits it in the rough. They give her a drop for casual water on a hill into the fairway. How do you get a drop into the fairway, by the way? And she hits it on the green. Granted, great shot, makes the cut. We go into a playoff. I lose. I'm not bitter, but yeah.
No, you don't sound like it. You don't sound like it's still sitting with you. But just 20 years later, you're, nah, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't think about it daily. You know, the nice thing this year was we got a chance to go back and do an event. We did the U.S. Women's Amateur at a place that you won your first U.S. Women's Open at. And let me just tell you, if you ever want to feel really important, go to like an old Waverly with Julie Inkster, because people were, I mean, you had volunteers coming up. I was here when you won. I remember you said this and we did that. It was quite the coronation for you. I know you'd been back once before, but it was pretty fun to be at that golf course with you in particular.
It was, you know, it's always great to go back to courses that you've had a lot of success and they are, I mean, they love their golf and they were passionate about having the U.S. Amateur there, and you know, it was a great tournament. Gabrielle just put on a clinic as far as closing out a match, and I'm sure Alban's going to be thinking about that for the rest of her life too. So little things like that kind of, you know, get you in your craw a little bit.
Yeah, they kind of sit with you for sure. By the way, have you, what currently your golf game currently, do you have it figured out, or are you searching?
I'm searching. I'm going to go hit balls after this, Shane, just to kind of go figure it out. We got a nice day here in Los Altos, about 75 degrees, and it's going to be a perfect time.
Yeah, I was talking to a couple of friends. I had dinner a couple of nights ago with some guys out here for the Charles Schwab Cup, and they recently did a video from Pasatiempo I've still never played it. And I said, my goal and my rule is I'm only going to play Paso Tiempo if you'll play with me, because I know it's a place that you get a chance to play a decent amount. And I want to have the Julie Inkster inside information about where to play the holes.
Well, you know what? Where your drives go and where my drives go are two different area codes. But I would be honored. I think it's a golf course that you would love to play.
Yeah, it looks awesome. You know, I got to give you a quick shout out, by the way. We played, I think it was Mossy Oak. We played this summer. We were doing the women's amateur at Old Waverly, went across the street. And you played from the back tees, Julie. You would not move up. You go, I'm playing back here with you guys. And it was, I would say you were probably the A player that day anyway, no matter what club you were hitting into the green. So I was impressed. My sister would be proud of that. She was always pretty anti-women's tees to begin with. So Julie used to play in the backs.
Having two older brothers and growing up around guys playing golf, that's how I grew up. You know, it's kind of in your DNA. But I think there was one hole that I did move up because I don't think I could have reached it in two.
it was like, no, the carry's 230 over that. I'm moving up. We're good to go.
But, yeah, I'm moving up one more.
That was fun. Julie, I appreciate it. Have a great off season. We'll see you before you know it. I mean, the season's going to come right up on us. But senior women's, I'm assuming you're playing in, and then, you know, all the events we get to do.
Yep, I'll be there and give little Henry a hug for me.
I will do. He'll be happy to. He keeps growing. He's growing like a weed. It's pretty crazy. But I'm going to take him to his first golf tournament this weekend, so hopefully he enjoys it.
Oh, there you go. Is it a backpack or how you doing?
I'm gonna stroller it. I'm gonna pack the stroller.
Oh, stroller.
I'm gonna go try to park as close to the clubhouse as possible. He'll probably last about an hour. I'm gonna try to go follow Flesh's group so we can cry and Steve Flesh's backswing and Flesh can get mad at us. That's the goal. That's our goal. That's the plan for the weekend.
All right, give Fleshy my best. You guys, thanks again, Shane.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole.
Alrighty, a big thanks to Julie Inkster for jumping on. Big thanks to you for listening. If you like the podcast, if you like the clubhouse, write a review. Tell your friends. That helps us out. We give you this for free, for goodness sakes. All you got to do is listen to me talk by myself for about 4 minutes, and then you get to hear from a Hall of Famer. That's all you need. A big thanks to Titleist and everybody at Fox that's involved in helping make this podcast what it is. We'll be back next week. Have a great weekend.